Bob Barr, USC, 70, then George Washington and Georgetown Law School. Background in the law, spent a number of years at the CIA, have been practicing in Georgia since the late 1970s, served as the United States Attorney for the Northern District under President Reagan, appointed by Reagan. Did that for about 4 years, and then went back to the practice of law. Did a lot of criminal law, a lot of litigation, and then was elected to the House in 1994, served 8 years in the House, was involuntarily retired, shall we say, in 1990 and 2002. And now I'm back practicing law, doing a lot of writing, and serving as head of a C4 called Liberty Guard. Have had the opportunity over the last several years to do a number of programs for the Federalist Society, many of them with John Yoo. I don't know whether any of you are familiar with John Yoo. John Yoo is a law professor up at Berkeley, just up the road from y'all, and was an official in the Bush administration, Bush II. He and I, John Yoo and I, have debated a number of times over the years about executive powers of the president, as reflected in, for example, the Patriot Act and the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and so forth. He and I have, shall we say, somewhat different views on that. He believes in a much more robust executive than I do. But aside from that, I've had a great relationship with John Yoo, and I've always enjoyed working with the Federalist Society, both here in Atlanta, where I practice and live, and other locations. I was really hoping to be able to be with you all today in person, but apparently the my view of freedom does not comport with that of Los Angeles, the government of Los Angeles. And I worked with Gregory, and we tried to, you know, find some way to get around the what I consider ridiculous mandate to have to wear a mask when you're speaking to a group. And Gregory even got me in touch with one of the officials there at the school, and we just were not able to work around the mask requirement, which, and I think it's ridiculous to try and give a speech with a mask on, but those are the rules, and that moved us into the Zoom world here. So I'm still very happy to be with you all today. I wish I could be there in person, and perhaps Gregory, if there is another opportunity in the future when we are not forced to operate under the COVID constraints that prevail in places like Los Angeles and California and some others, do let me know, because I would, again, love to be with you all in person out there and to meet with you. But so here we are, and Gregory asked me to talk a little bit today about the two-party system that we have here in the United States. Although technically it's not a two-party system, the reality is that it is a two-party system. I ran for president on the Libertarian Party ticket in 2008 and discovered firsthand that it is virtually impossible, maybe not impossible, but virtually impossible for a third-party candidate or an independent candidate to compete reasonably in a presidential race. Ross Perot did so when he put together the Reform Party. He had a substantial advantage over myself and other third-party candidates in that he was very wealthy and put a great deal of money into his Reform Party. But that was really the last time that a non-Democrat or Republican was able to mount a competitive race for president. We're very constrained, therefore, in with a two-party system here. And to be honest with you, it's difficult. My memory goes back, obviously, a lot further than you all's. I graduated from SC back in 70 and law school in 77. But I cannot remember a president of either party putting together a coherent speech that outlines with a degree of eloquence that probably we all like to see as lawyers in not only fellow attorneys, but in public officials. Ronald Reagan, I think, was justifiably a great orator and gave, I think, some wonderful speeches. Y'all may remember reading about a speech that he gave in October of 1964, a couple of years before he was elected governor. He gave a speech in October of 1964 in behalf of Barry Goldwater, who in 64 was the Republican Party nominee. Did not fare very well. But the speech that Reagan gave in 1964, right before that election, was really probably one of the best political speeches that I've, I didn't hear it, but reading it, and I have listened to it, recordings of it. The point I'm trying to make is political parties, the Republican and Democrat political parties nowadays, and ever since the 1980s, really, neither has been a party that puts together and articulates a coherent, consistent strategy to accomplish principled goals. A lot of people think, well, there's really not much difference between the Republican Party and the Democrat Party. And in many ways, that's true, except for a matter of degree, perhaps. One party might want to spend $5 trillion and the other $2 trillion. But both parties are I'm sorry, I had a call I had to get rid of there. But both parties don't articulate anything approaching a coherent, principled strategy for accomplishing, again, principled goals. They have goals they want to accomplish, get more votes than the other side. Maybe spend money a little bit differently from the other party. But beyond that, there's really not much that lends itself to characterizing either the Republican or the Democrat Party as a party of great principles, great eloquence. Really just the opposite. That's partly a result of the media that defines political campaigning. But part of it is the fact that more than anything else, people turn to political leaders for things. They want money. They want regulatory powers. And really, government in these United States in, over the past couple of generations, really, has become really not much more than a means to an end, and that end being money, resources. And those come through various programs, so-called entitlements, whatnot. Congress has three responsibilities, really. They legislate. We all know what that is. They pass legislation, and if it passes both houses in identical form, it goes to the president, and the president signs it, occasionally vetoes. But everybody is familiar with the legislative power that the Congress has in Article I. People also are familiar, certainly, with the other significant power that Congress has, and that is to dole out money, to appropriate money. The third power that Congress has, though, is in many respects, perhaps the most important, but the least used, and that is the oversight power of the Congress. Occasionally, it does work somewhat well. Just this week, yesterday, and I think today in the House, but yesterday in the Senate, we saw the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, and the Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, and I think the commander of CENTCOM, Central Command General, testified before the Senate, and I think also today, I haven't seen it today, but there were, in fact, some legitimate substantive issues that were discussed and did come up through the Q&A of those witnesses. But more often than not, as a matter of fact, almost always, public hearings by the Congress, the House and the Senate, really don't delve into great substance. It's simply, more than anything else, a way for members of the House or members of the Senate to score political points or to grab a headline or a soundbite that can be used in an election. And there's nothing wrong with that, certainly. It's important for members of Congress to do what they can to make sure that their views are known, made known to their constituents. But if the primary purpose of holding an oversight hearing is to ensure that the executive branch is operating within the letter and the intent of legislation, you're almost always going to be disappointed because there's very little that comes out of most of these hearings. And that's, again, part of the problem that we have with a strict two-party system. And that is, neither the Republican nor the Democrat Party really, when push comes to shove, they don't really want to limit the power of the other party. That is because sooner or later, the other party is going to be back in power. So for example, if you have a Republican-controlled Congress and a Democrat president, the Republicans in the Congress may howl about how important it is to limit the power of this Democrat president and what awful things he or she is doing. But if you look at what actually happens in terms of limiting the power of the executive, not much happens. If the Democrats, on the other hand, are in a majority in the Congress and the president is a Republican, the Democrats, similar to their Republican brethren and sisters, they will howl greatly about how important it is to limit what this terrible Republican president is doing and how important it is to rein in the executive power. But nothing happens. And that's because, again, each party knows that in a two-party system, the other party will get back into power, or their party will get back into power, and they don't want to have their power limited. So even though there's a great deal of dust that is churned up in terms of a party controlling the Congress, going after a president of the other party, at the end of the day, when all of that dust settles down, and it eventually does, to be kicked up again later, nothing really happens. And that, I think, is probably, to me, the most serious drawback to having a strict two-party system. There's no incentive for either party to place any form of limits, even when they're clearly justified, on a president or an executive branch controlled by the other party. And any president who comes into office, at least in the modern era, has no incentive, himself or herself, to place any limits themselves on the exercise of the office into which they are entering. Best way to think of this, I have found, is to consider that every president who comes into office views the powers that they inherited from their predecessor not as a ceiling, but as a floor to be built on. At at least again in the modern era, no president takes office and says, well, I am not going to do anything to expand the power of this office beyond what my predecessor had. And as a matter of fact, I'm going to do everything I can to place limits on the power of the presidency to bring us more, at least a little ways back into accord with the, you know, constitutional framework in which the power of the government generally is to be limited, as all of us have seen and then read in the Federalist Papers, a government of very defined and specific powers. How far we've gotten from that is amazing. When you look at what our two-party system, even before the two-party system, but particularly during the era of a two-party system over the last really century and a half, I suppose, there have been very, very few, very minor, almost imperceptible instances in which the power of the federal government, either congressional or executive, has been truly limited. Even, for example, back during the Vietnam War era, when Congress puffed and puffed and exerted itself in terms of war powers, they were upset with the manner by which President Johnson and then President Nixon had exercised executive power in Vietnam in particular. So they passed the War Powers Act. If you look back, though, over the last half century, that War Powers Act has been in effect, you'd really be hard-pressed to find any evidence that it has had any effect on how a president conducts military action overseas. Because there are, in fact, in the War Powers Act, like virtually every other piece of legislation that's been signed into law, sufficient wiggle room so you can really, the president can always get around it, can find some way to get around it, even if that is simply ignoring the requirements of the law, knowing almost to a certainty that Congress ultimately is not really going to do anything about it. It's interesting. I've read a couple of books recently. One of them is a book called The Men Who Lost America. It's about British generals and politicians during a Revolutionary War era whose decision-making resulted in the colonialists' victories at Yorktown and then shortly thereafter, the victory over Great Britain in the Treaty of Paris. The other book I've read recently is a book called Are We Rome? Looking at parallels, if any, and there are, between America's position in the world today as contrasted with Rome's position, both in the couple of centuries BC and then a few centuries afterwards. The purpose of neither of these books is really to be critical of any U.S. president or either the Republican or the Democrat Party, but it I find it very interesting that in both instances, that is looking at the Roman experience and the British experience, the British-American experience, the problems that both governments face, that is the British government trying to wage a defensive war to protect its colonies from formally breaking away, and the experiences of successive Roman emperors and other politicians, generals, to maintain the Roman Empire over a very, very long centuries, long period of time. What fascinates me in looking at books like this, and Victor Davis Hanson has written similarly about military activities over the centuries, is what I find very fascinating is the problems that Roman governments had to deal with in maintaining their grip on power, and the problems that the British monarch and his generals during the American Revolution conflict were precisely the same sorts of problems that our government deals with now. Not having enough money, taxing up to a point and not beyond that point because people will rebel. The problems of bureaucracy. The Romans faced precisely the same kind of bureaucratic problems and inertia that we see our government suffering under today. So despite the tremendous advances in technology that are supposed to enlighten our civilization, they really don't. Ultimately, the human condition is the same now. Those things that motivate people, the problems that governments face are the same today with all this great technology that we have as were faced hundreds and thousands of years ago by the Romans, and the same as the problems that infected the British fight to preserve its empire against these rebellious American colonialists. I don't know how we get out of this system where we're locked into the two-party system and there's this built-in inertia against any meaningful change. And you add on top of that, Gregory, for example, the lack of civility that we have in the public arena nowadays, which is far, far worse than it was just, you know, however many years ago it was when I was in the Congress. And you have a recipe for, if not disaster, certainly a recipe for lack of progress in solving problems and dealing with issues. So y'all are in a much better position than I am, looking forward to trying to work these problems through. But the lack of interest or understanding on the part of our elected officials and most candidates nowadays in the Constitution and originalism, familiarity with such basic tools to understand our government as the Federalist Papers is discouraging. Our founders recognized that this system of government that they created, it's fascinating to me what they did, genius. But they warned us that it will only work if you have an open society and an educated citizenry. And less do we have that nowadays. So you all have your work cut out for you as young people about to, you know, get out there, and hopefully many of you will become involved in public policy, maybe as candidates yourselves. But our two-party system is not doing us well. And the ultimate responsibility for that lies with we the people. We are not demanding civility on the part of our public officials. We're not demanding substance. We're not demanding an understanding of history and the Constitution. And this is one of the great benefits to me of the Federalist Society. The Federalist Society does exactly that, tries to educate not just lawyers, but others and the non-legal profession. And in order to educate, you have to have civility. And the Federalist Society does that. They do it magnificently. So again, very much enjoyed, Gregory, the opportunity to be with you all today. I just wish it could be in person. But if you'd like to open it up, for some questions or comments, there are all manner of issues to talk about these days, whether it's those issues that were on the front page of the congressional or the congressional platter today and yesterday with regard to the role of the military in our society, whether it's Second Amendment issues. I'll be attending a board meeting and membership meeting of the National Rifle Association on which board I serve this weekend. There are very important Second Amendment issues on the agenda for the Supreme Court. So, if there are some issues, how much time do we have till 4 o'clock, Gregory?
We have until probably around like 1:10.
Until what?
Around like 1:10.
Okay. Yeah. So well, I'm going by.
I wanted to ask about ballot access, since this was something you faced during your presidential run.
Mm-hmm.
To what extent do you feel like the two-party system affects the ability of third-party candidates to gain access?
It's almost absolute. Not quite absolute. Here in Georgia, for example, for up until this year, I believe, the number of signatures that a third-party candidate would have in order to qualify to be on the ballot with the Republicans and Democrats made it, for all intents and purposes, impossible. And challenges have been brought. There was a challenge that resulted in a court decision just a few months ago, Gregory, that loosened up those requirements substantially. I forget the exact number. You shouldn't have to bring a years long legal challenge just to get on the ballot. Now, that's not to say that everybody that wants to be on the ballot should automatically get on the ballot. That would be chaos, and we have enough chaos without chaos nowadays. But it's very difficult. The best example I can think of from my personal experience, and that is when I ran in 2008. By the way, I'm a Republican now. I was what moved me to the Libertarian Party and running for president in 2008 was, more than anything else, the disregard for fundamental civil liberties by the Bush administration. That's a little bit better nowadays. It's still a constant battle, whether it's surveillance or Fourth Amendment issues, Second Amendment issues, or whatnot. The best example, going back to ballot access, that I can convey my personal experience was in Texas. Each party, or any party, has to file certain papers by a certain day declaring its nominee. And I don't recall, Gregory, whether it was the Republican Party, but don't hold me to that. One of the two major parties just disregarded that requirement, didn't file the papers. So we filed an action in court in Texas to have that party, and we did comply with the requirements to be on the ballot in Texas. But we had to file an action in court to have one of the other parties, again, I think it was the Republican Party, removed, because they very clearly, on the face of it, had not complied with the law. And it was just because they didn't want to. And the court summarily dismissed our action. So the two-party system, Gregory, is so much the status quo. And to me, the most powerful force in the universe is the force of the status quo. The status quo is that the Republican Party and the Democrat Party are the two parties, not just the two major parties, but the two parties that the establishment, the government, all three branches of our government see as the only real legitimate vehicles for candidates. It's very difficult. When you have to get 5%, for example, of registered voters, or 10% of registered voters in the state, just to be able to be on the ballot. This has nothing to do with ensuring that there is not chaos and that there are only legitimate candidates that are on the ballot. It simply has to do with the Republican Party and the Democrat Party not wanting competition. And that's why we don't have competition beyond the two major parties.
Would you be open to answering questions specifically about recent Libertarian Party candidates, like what your thoughts are on how third parties are currently trying to break through, or reasons why they would be unsuccessful just as messaging?
I'm not, you know, I haven't been active in the Libertarian Party since 2008, so I'm not really that familiar. Gary Johnson, of course, ran, I guess, two terms ago. And was a legitimate candidate, former two-term governor of New Mexico, had a way of campaigning that was a little bit different from most people's, but he was a legitimate candidate. I'm not familiar with the more recent ones. I do know that the Libertarian Party, and I'm not saying anything against them or that I haven't said to them, but the Libertarian Party, by and large, has never decided once and for all what it is. And that is it a legitimate, practical, political party? Or is it a debating society? And you see this in the meeting, or I saw it in the meetings that I would attend of the Libertarian Party committee. You'd have, you could almost draw a line right down the middle of a table of the members of the committee, those that simply view the party as a debating society, and that's fine, and those that understood that if you are going to be a political party, then behave like one, do certain things, organize yourself, select good candidates to the extent that you can, raise money. That takes a very different type of effort than simply talking about the philosophical issues underlying your view of government. And until the Libertarian Party decides once and for all that it really is and wants to be a party that can challenge the other two parties, as opposed to just being a vehicle to raise issues and discuss those issues, which is important in and of itself, certainly, then it's not going to have a major effect on politics, even aside from the difficulties that any third party has.
Mr. Boer, my name is Marshall Maya. I'm actually an undergraduate here at SC, so I'm not currently a law student. About a year ago, I had a friend of mine and I who shared more contrarian perspectives than perhaps like the views of the conventional views of students here at the undergraduate level. We decided to start this publication on campus to kind of provide a platform for students at SC who had perhaps more conservative or contrarian views on perhaps issues of policy or various legal topics to have an outlet to voice their views in a civil manner. I guess my question for you is, as somebody who's rose through the ranks and rise to prominence within the conservative establishment or the Republican Party or the Libertarian Party, what would your advice be to young conservatives perhaps at the undergraduate level or even at the law school level to kind of shift the way in which the discourse on campus is so dominated by one particular view, if that makes sense?
Well, it makes sense, and you put your finger on one of the really major problems, not just with academia and education, but our society in general. When you have a society in which those institutions like universities are supposed to be bastions of the very freedoms that allow them to exist, if they become, as many are becoming, part of this so-called cancel culture, and not wishing to have debate, not allowing debate, then you've got a real problem. I mean, we have two extremes here. Marshall?
Yes.
We have two extremes here, Marshall. We have, you know, best personified by the Congress these days, in which all they want to do is argue. And they'd be happy if, I guess they could just argue 24/7. Some of them do. So there's no shortage of debate in the Congress. Now, you know, certainly there's a legitimate question about the substance of those debates, but there is debate. And then contrast that with what we have in many businesses now, and social media now, and academia now, where those who control the levers of communication use that power to avoid debate, to limit debate, to fight against debate, and to ensure that opposing views are not in fact heard. I mean, that is a terrible recipe for tyranny. How do you solve that? There's no easy way, but it has to be solved if we're going to continue to exist as a society that bears any relationship at all to what we were intended by our framers to be. I suppose ultimately some of these issues are going to be decided by the courts. Part of the problem is even great private universities like SC take government money. And therefore are subject to a great deal of control with regard to the freedom that they can use to further their educational excellence. Hillsdale College in Michigan does not take any federal monies, directly or indirectly. You can't get a government guaranteed loan to go to Hillsdale. That gives them tremendous freedom. They don't need to pay attention to the department, U.S. Department of Education. You can't just undo all of those strings that the universities, that tie university monies to the federal government. That's part of the problem. President Trump, through his Secretary of Education, did try and move a little bit in the direction of bringing something called due process back to universities. If a student at a university is accused of sexual harassment, for example, or worse, right now, it is basically a procedure that unfolds with virtually no due process for the accused student, which is outrageous, that one loses one's equal protection of the law or due process to defend oneself simply because they have been accused in a university or by somebody in a university. That anybody would advocate for that or defend that tells you just how deep the problem that you've identified really is. Due process is, you know, one of the underpinnings along with property rights that define our society. Without due process, without property rights, without the right to contract, it becomes virtually impossible for advancements to be made. So fight this cancel culture in the courts, support those organizations that advocate for actual freedom of expression and open debate. And you know, whether it's through supporting or having a membership in an organization like Federalist Society, in my arena, for example, I urge people who care about Second Amendment rights and who are against gun control to support the NRA and other similarly similar organizations, but the same in the academic arena. Hollywood, media, these corporations have become so woke that they bear no relationship to what they used to be. Disney, for example. And there will be challenges. Again, in the educational arena, President Trump, and I'm not here advocating for President Trump by any stretch of the imagination, this is one area where he did try and pull back some of these outrageous restrictions on freedom of expression and the lack of due process in academia. Unfortunately, like pretty much everything else with the Biden administration, anything that President Trump did, regardless of the merit, they are trying to reverse. And education and Title IX and so forth is one of those areas. So it's going to become difficult again, but don't give up. I mean, if we continue down this road where due process means nothing, where civil discourse means nothing, then we're going to wind up in a pretty dark place, which when President Reagan, when he gave that speech in 1964, even though he was talking more about totalitarianism from abroad, he ended his speech. You all might have heard this. He ended that speech to the nationwide audience. He said, "You and I have a rendezvous with destiny. We'll preserve for our children this, the last best hope of man on earth, or we'll sentence them to take the last step into 1,000 years of darkness." We don't necessarily really face the same threat from communism, the Soviet Union in particular, that the United States did back then, which was primarily what Reagan was talking about. But the threats to our freedom, the threats to that light that was started by our founders in the late 18th century, it's in danger of being snuffed out. And universities, unfortunately, are one of the prime places where that's happening. So fight like the Dickens against this this cancel culture and this wokeness.
Okay, one last question, because I think we're reaching like 1 p.m. But regarding President Trump and the two-party system, specifically, do you think that there is a big concern for how candidates who can sort of take the main view of a party can affect other states? Like here in California, we had an opponent to Newsom in a recall who was easy to be called the Trump candidate, and it really hurt him from winning.
It's very important for the Republican Party that the Republican Party pay far more attention and place a much higher value on the candidates that they choose. And this is difficult where you have a president or a former president that exerts tremendous power over a party. But if the party does not stand up for substance and does not bring good candidates forward, and I'm not saying Trump is a good or a bad candidate, you probably can discern that, but the Republican Party has, I think, a tremendous farm team out there, some very, very good candidates in the Senate and governors and members of Congress. But unless the Republican voter is willing to look beyond simply a label or simply an endorsement, a lot of those candidates are going to go away. And that will be to the great detriment of the party. I don't really want to get too much into the Trump thing, but a party has to be, if it's going to be a legitimate, substantive political vehicle to affect positive change in society, it cannot be tied entirely to one person. There's got to be substance there. And that substance has to be articulated consistently and transparently. And in the absence of that, you know, we might as well go home.
I actually had a question to piggyback off of that. Do you think there's any one particular issue or perhaps a collection of issues that, say, that the GOP or the RNC could use to kind of unify the Trump-esque base of the Republican Party and perhaps those more consistent with being a Reagan conservative or more of the typical establishment conservative? Like, do you think there's one particular issue or a collection of certain issues that the GOP could kind of campaign on that would unify those two opposing groups within the party? Or do you think they're starkly different and it's just a matter of whether or not they'll support each other for like the overall cause?
Man, is that difficult, Marshall. One of the things that drives me crazy is what both parties, but particularly the Republican Party, articulates. The party and its leaders keep articulating that the main responsibility, the primary responsibility of government is to keep us safe. No, that's not the primary job of our government. The primary job of our government, going back again to the Federalist Papers, is to protect individual liberty, to ensure that individual liberty is protected. If we continue down this track of, well, as long as you know, the primary responsibility is to keep us safe, you know, then that opens the door to all manner of despotic and totalitarian measures. We see that in all of this COVID stuff nowadays, which is unfortunately just getting started, the nonsense. It's very difficult to distinguish between the two and chart that course where you could take, for example, the good ideas that Trump has, and he has some good ideas, the regulatory arena in particular, and some aspects of his national security and his domestic security agenda. But we've become too wedded to individuals and what issue would be the best to distinguish us and to try and chart a course that, you know, isn't against any particular person in the party, but stands for substance and can rekindle what Reagan started with the modern conservative movement really back in the 1960s. I think has to do with, you know, personal freedom. I mean, we have to be the party that says the individual is primary in this country, not the government, and not government institutions. And you can, you know, fashion that, apply that to whether it's air travel, whether it's safety on the streets and the responsibility that lies with an individual to protect themselves, not the police, which is why we have the Second Amendment, whether it has to do with ensuring that we do not have unlawful surveillance. It's individual liberty. And that's what Reagan talked about, even before he was president. It's always been what used to distinguish the Republican Party from the Democrat Party. And, you know, despite all of the civil libertarians that rose up through the Democrat Party, at the root or at the end point for them, it was always government to do it. The Republican Party used to be the party that stood for individual liberty. And we have to get back to that. Otherwise, again, you know, the two parties are just going to kind of merge and, you know, there might be slight differences at the edge, but both of them will be parties of big government.
Okay, thank you. And it was nice having you here to speak with us, even if it was over Zoom. We'll make sure next year, hopefully, if like they let the pandemic end by then, to invite you to speak in person.
Well, I'd love to do that, Gregory. And even though I'm much prefer in person to Zoom, if there's another opportunity to speak with some of you and some of your colleagues there at the law school, let me know. I'd be glad to do it.
Okay, thank you.
Y'all take care.